This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
You bitch!
No idea how bad it gets.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy?
Don't stomp your little lassies at Prada Shida Mil on you.
John Callio, will you go around with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a curve?
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you ain't wanted, Ennis. So what we got now is broke back mouth.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are turning our attention to gay men and their bodies.
A topic I'm right across, Daniel. Alan, how about you?
It's been such a long time.
We are...
I'm a little slow on the uptake, but that was good. I like it.
We're asking whether the gay community has a preoccupation with the body beautiful, and if it does, whether Hollywood is complicit with that preoccupation. And to help us with this inquiry, we're going to be joined by Dreamboat director Tristan Malewski. So we're going to speak with Tristan about his probing new documentary, which is actually available online, and what it has to say about the relationship between the gay community and the body beautiful. But what I also love about a topic like this is that, you know, we could look at any queer film, really any queer film, particularly gay films, and they would furnish kind of fertile ground for this kind of conversation. Films like Moonlight are ripe with these ideas about masculinity and the body and the way that the body is a kind of locus for masculinity. And by kind of cultivating these muscular physiques, we find way to express kind of traditional, hegemonic, patriarchal masculinity.
Hegy what?
We'll take that as a comment, as we always do.
No, that's cool. Yeah, I'm with you.
Well, that's the thing. We really struggled to almost narrow down, because there are so many ways we could take this and look at this.
Right.
And
now,
like, we were kind of, first we were struggling to look at films that really almost, we almost kind of put the gaze of, okay, what objectify bodies in that space? And then we started looking at films like Moonlight, talking about films about Call Me By Your Name. So we really started, it's such a massive topic.
It's a massive topic. And we have dealt with this topic on Outtakes before in various ways. So if you recall, in 2016, actually, we had Peter Lehman on the program. Peter Lehman wrote a book called Running Scared in the early 90s, which was a seminal text that looked at the way that Hollywood actually hides men's bodies. So Hollywood is very good at putting women's bodies on display. But traditionally, it's hidden men's bodies. And Peter Lehman argued that the reason Hollywood does that is because really men's bodies aren't very special. And if we show men's bodies, what we do is
speak
kind
of yourself.
Well,
I'm just going to stay out of that part of it.
This is what Peter argued. And this book is a classic, right?
Yeah.
Peter argued that by hiding men's bodies, we preserve the authority of the phallus, right?
Yes,
of masculinity.
So this
is what he argued, that there's this connection, right, between masculinity in society and the male body.
Mm-hmm.
And that by hiding the male body, we preserve the authority of traditional masculinity. And of course, when we do see the body, it's one of two things. It's either this kind of impossibly chiseled physique or this kind of comical farce, right? And so what does this tell us? This tells us that the way to do masculinity successfully is to have these kind of impossible physiques. This is what Hollywood is teaching us. At least that's what Lehman argued. And it's a strong point, because if we look at You know, we were chatting before about the superhero genre, right?
Yes.
Without a doubt.
Well, I don't recall ever seeing a superhero in Hollywood that had a belly.
Actually, I think I remember you mentioned Tobey Maguire in Spider-Man just right. outside. And I was like, oh, my God, yes. The minute he gains powers, he gains pecs. He gains a six-pack.
Right.
He gains height.
So he goes to bed.
Yeah.
This kind of scrawny prepubescent, with this kind of scrawny prepubescent body. And so then he wakes up the next morning muscular. And we are supposed...
And powerful.
Would we describe him as a twink in that sense?
You might.
You know, young, thin, no, I think, and skinny.
Yeah. yeah. But and so then he wakes up.
So he's moving from twink to kind of...
muscle jock.
Yeah.
But
Here's the thing, though. As soon as we see his body, as an audience, we automatically know that he has been vested with some kind of superpower. We do. It's this kind of association that we have with a skinny body. We don't kind of associate this kind of power.
Mm.
And then as soon as that kind of flips and he's kind of wakes up with this kind of impossibly muscular body, we know straight away that he has some kind of superhuman power. And we were chatting before,
were laughing at your library collection. Yes.
Well, yeah, Peter Lehman's theory is one theory. And then I brought in this text, the Adonis Complex. And what it does is use the example of action figure dolls, superhero action figure dolls. And this is a billion-dollar industry, right? But what the authors say, what they show, is that, say, a G.I. Joe doll from the 1970s in America had, if they adjusted it to reflect the body of a average man, the average G.I. Joe doll had a 32-inch waist, a 44-inch chest, and a 12-inch bicep. Which
I thought you were about to say something else there for a second. I thought that would be for an anatomically correct G.I. Joe.
Yeah, none of them have any of
doll.
No.
But the point is that...
A 12-inch bicep.
Well, that's...
just to clarify.
These are...
Head circumference.
These are kind of... That's standard for someone in reasonable physical shape.
Yep.
Those are standard kind of dimensions. Mm-hmm. By the time we get to the mid-90s, the doll has a 27-inch chest. 27-inch waist. Which is actually the same circumference as his bicep.
Wow.
So the bicep increases from 12 inches to 27 inches and the waist decreases. So,
do they have the circumference of Barbie's waist?
Well, we know that Barbie's waist is even slighter than 20.
Yeah.
But here's the point. So this is a billion-dollar industry and it's reflected on our screens. This is what people grow up with and without even thinking, take as normal.
Welcome to our world.
And we actually see Hollywood actors go through this transformation specifically.
Don't we?
So look at Hugh Jackman from Wolverine. From one film to the next, he keeps on getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
All
the Hemsway brothers.
Chris Pratt, who went from the kind of chubby, lovable comedian to the kind of muscular superhero and now only plays kind of Hollywood's leading man.
I know, he's gone from not to hot. I mean, he's everywhere.
So I think there is so much that can be said about the way that Hollywood kind of mediates this relationship between men and their bodies, or between people and their bodies more broadly. But we kind of have to kind of hone in our focus tonight, and specifically we're looking at the way that Hollywood mediates the relationship between
that preoccupation with that absolute body beautiful,
and the way that we do get some queer films that more than others really do kind of deal with these issues. And one great example is the new documentary Dreamboat, which
You're
giving me a face.
Documentary, I think, it's a generous term. Yes, it is a documentary.
It is a documentary.
But I think it's a bit generous. I felt like it was an audition for a lot of the men playing in this film. Fascinating.
An audition in what sense? Because they're...
Look, we will be talking about Dreamboat later. It's a fascinating documentary. We've got we'll be interviewing the filmmaker first. Let's let him
the director,
have,
Kristen.
Yeah, let him have his, but you loved it, didn't you, Alan?
Yeah, Love Boat for the modern age.
I know you came in and you said,
Love
Boat
reimagined.
So what did you think of Love Boat? And I said, Alan, you're showing your age because that's the show we grew up with. Dreamboat.
No, I meant it. I meant it. I mean, it was meant to be ironic because they're on a gay cruise. I don't think you're going going to find love.
Well, I think
you're going to find a lot of everything else, just not a lot of love.
I think that's the point that the film actually makes, that it does say quite a bit about gay culture, and it makes these points about gay culture, and whether or not we accept them to be true, you know, I'm not saying they are true. I'm saying that this is the point that the filmmaker is making. You know, we can argue about whether or not it's actually a documentary, because it's clearly got it's telling a story,
you know,
isn't
it? Look, it's definitely a documentary, but the participants that then participate in it, I think, were far too self-conscious and never, but that in itself is telling their story in this world of body image.
Isn't
so it?
It
kind of fits perfect that these characters, these subjects of these films, these five guys, are so almost obsessed by the camera as they are about how they are presenting to the outside world. So it almost suits, but irritates me.
But the other thing, on a cruise ship, it is a microcosm. You can't escape.
How many were 3,000?
It's an artificial world.
So this is what the documentary is set on a cruise boat for gay men. There are 3,000 men on the boat, and it just kind of follows five or six men in particular, from different corners of the globe. We have to give the documentary that.
That's what I love the most about it.
At different ages as well. There are some older
and abilities.
Men. Yeah.
Yes.
So it does give us a good cross section of the gay community. And what the filmmaker tries to show us is that no matter, and we can question his findings because yes, it's clearly curated, but what Tristan tries to show us is that no matter from which corner of the world you come, gay men are kind of afflicted by these same kind of preoccupations. Mm-hmm. And that's strong language, but this is the message that Tristan is trying to convey with the documentary, that we are all searching.
Same, but different and fit.
That we're searching for love, searching for something, and yet these preoccupations get in the way of us ever actually finding true happiness. I think that's the point he tries to make.
And just for the record, I want to say being trapped on a cruise ship with 3,000 other gay men is my definition of a nightmare. That would be the worst.
I know.
I would never inflict myself.
No, I wouldn't either.
Okay, it was a different type of activity cruise, this one. I have to admit, I looked this, where after I watched the documentary,
I
wonder what lesbians would do on that sort of cruise. And it was, there was far more activity based than what the fellas got up to.
I'm sure the boys were very active. There's a lot of activity going on the Love Boat Dream Boat.
Yeah, it was very different entertainment.
Look, we're going to be
a bit more family friendly.
We're going to be speaking with the director of this documentary, Tristan Milewski. I'm sure I'm butchering his last name, but let's face it, I butcher most people's names. So we're going to be speaking with Tristan in a moment. But before we do, we want to know what film you think really captures these ideas. So what films do you think are almost unhealthy in the way they objectify men and kind of disseminate these attitudes about the male body, which we then kind of soak up? Are they superhero films like Spider-Man and Thor, or are they kind of queer, much loved queer films like Brokeback Mountain and even Call Me By Your Name, which have clear messages, if we look for them, about the way that men should look?
And that's the thing, when you guys see yourselves, are you actually seeing yourselves on film, or do these films make you feel that little bit
more invisible?
Exactly.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think we really want our listener to text in and let us know what film makes you feel like a man.
How you feel?
you know, channeling Shania Twain.
Much man, more succinctly
I feel like a woman.
Put.
Man, I always feel like
what
a woman.
Film
but anyway.
Makes you feel like a man.
Message in on 0427JOY949 or email us at onair@joy.org.au. You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we're looking at queer films that mediate the relationship between men and their bodies, and this kind of preoccupation that the gay community is often said to have with the body beautiful. And in fact, Alan, you were telling us before about a recent study which has shown us that there's actually some basis to this idea that the gay community does actually have a preoccupation with...
Look, Daniel, the results of this survey are quite damning and actually quite staggering, concerning. Attitude, the UK magazine surveyed 5,000 of its readers, and it came back with 83% of the respondents indicated that they were in some way unhappy with their body.
83%?
83%. 84% actually. You know, 49% reported feeling very unhappy. 49% reported being unhappy and 10% reported feeling very unhappy. And you know what?
I feel like that's a kind of blurry line. One man's very unhappy is another man's unhappy, you know.
But importantly, only 1% of those surveyed felt that they were very happy with the way that they looked.
See, I see these statistics and nothing jars at me. The reason nothing jars at me is because I've grown up knowing worse statistics.
Yeah.
From all the sort of media surrounding myself growing up, how I'm made to feel about my body and my body image. I see this night and it doesn't shock me. And it almost seems low. The 1%, very unhappy.
Very happy.
Yeah. Only 1% devastates me, but I've grown up not looking at these statistics all of my life.
Well, the interesting thing is that as a society, for some reason, and you know, I don't know what the reason is, but we've felt comfortable, I think, for some time having conversations about women and their body images.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be a good thing, but it might also be a bad thing. I don't know why that is, that we've been able to have a conversation about this in relation to women. But generally, we don't have conversations about men and their body images. And I think it does have to do with this idea that if you are masculine, you are inviolate. Your body is this kind of fortress and nothing can penetrate it, which is an interesting pun in itself.
Can I say
in
I was shocked, though, from this Attitude report, what it states about lesbian women?
Yeah, that's right. I think in the article it went on to further to say that there was a study...
Reported less dissatisfaction than heterosexual women? Really? Yeah.
2013.
Well, can I say that is quite a common... There are numerous studies out there which would support the same proposition. Whether or not it's true...
That lesbian women are generally happier with their body image than straight women?
Correct.
Yep.
Like there are a number of articles out there which report the same statistic.
I'd like to see those statistics,
but they're out there. I don't pretend that they're true. I don't know, but it is a commonly held. It is commonly accepted
because the images of lesbians we've quite often seen on screen are women that don't play this body. You know, they don't fall into the same categories. We were talking about this before.
Exactly. Peter Lehman talks about the way that masculinity is kind of divided on screen. On the one hand, you have these kind of muscular, desirable bodies, and on the other hand, you have these kind of flabby, undesirable, comical bodies.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, lesbians are often situated on that side with the kind of they're not represented in a very flattering way often.
And that's it. The example I'm going to give was when the L Word first came out. Mm. So, you know, the same, pretty much a similar filmmakers to what made Go Fish. They received absolute flack when that first went to air because they were presenting these perfect, you know, successful, rich, body, beautiful, gorgeous women.
And that's absolutely the truth.
And they're that was the all truth. Gorgeous. And they had received the exact opposite criticism with a film like Go Fish, that they weren't presenting. So they can't get it right.
Well, but here's the thing.
Like, as in they can't make anyone happy with what they put on screen.
But you can't. You just can't. Like, we know from the...
But it was rare to see women like that.
We know from the statistics that we get from... the MQFF surveys, which they carry out after every festival, no one is ever really everyone wants more of something, you know. And so the question isn't so much like what do people want to see on the screen. The question is really what are we getting in our film? What messages is cinema conveying to us about the way that we should look? And are we subtly, without realizing, subconsciously kind of picking up and soaking up and then using to kind of frame the way we see ourselves in the world? And this is a kind of conversation that we've started on Outtakes before. Some time ago, I don't know if you recall, we had Dwayne Duncan on the program, who's a lecturer in the School of Behavioral, Cognitive and Social Sciences at the University of New England. And he's done a lot of research into masculinities and the way that the body is used as this kind of metonym for masculinity. And here's what Dwayne had to say when he was on the program.
you know, as I mentioned, there are historical associations between gay men and femininity and narcissism. Mm. But also contemporary gay life is built around a very public expression of sexuality. When you come out as a gay man, it's a very complicated process. You're reflecting on what it means to be gay and what it looks like to be gay. You're coming out as someone different from everyone else, and that involves a lot of reflection on the body. Mm. So what I think is actually occurring is that the body's the site for the expression of a gay identity, both socially and in terms of how we put ourselves forward as a community, but also individually.
You've written, Dwayne, that the athletic body ideal has become central to gay life. How do you mean?
I think it's hard not to participate in any aspect of gay life and see that there's a certain hierarchy around particular bodies, and that certain bodies are more esteemed seem to have more social privilege. We can see that in heterosexual culture too, that certain bodies have certain moral values, certain bodies are more desirable, and those ideals play out in very negative ways for people who are invested in those ideals. Historically in the 70s and the 80s, the embodiment of the clone look was, a rejection of those kind of effeminate stereotypes that had circulated in the decades previously. There's also something within gay liberation politics too, which is about celebrating the body and celebrating sexual life, celebrating sexual freedom. And so the very idealized athletic body that supposedly we all wish to embody and we all desire in our partners, it kind of sits there in gay liberation politics too as a symbol of a terrific sexual future that's open to all of us when it's clearly not.
That was part of our chat with Dwayne Duncan, and you can access the full chat that we had with Dwayne Duncan on the Outtakes podcast page on Joy's website. But I think he's made some really interesting points, far more eloquently than at least I've been able to this evening, about the way that within gay culture, but also within culture more broadly, we have this way of kind of hierarchizing bodies and attributing moral value to certain bodies based on the way they look. Mm-hmm. And what we see is that Hollywood and queer cinema certainly reifies and re-articulates this hierarchy.
And reinforces it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, after all, we all have referred to this particular social class within the gay community as the A-gays, and every A-gay is fit and toned and beautiful.
You've referred to them
social
as the A-gays.
Social privilege, is that?
Come on. And it comes out in film often. They often refer to...
Oh, absolutely.
You'll often hear them referred to as the A-gays.
A perfect example is Moonlight, and we're going to explore Moonlight and what it has to say about the body and masculinity later. But I think that's an excellent example of the point that you're making. Mm. Another really great example, which hopefully we'll have time to explore later, is a film called Goat, which was an Andrew Neil film which came out a couple of years ago, which I think does a really wonderful... It's an average film, but it does a really wonderful job of juxtaposing different types of male bodies within a very male world and showing how the body is used as this kind of locus for value as a man. Mm. I think it plays with those ideas in a really interesting way. Mm. Another film which does that is Dreamboat.
Really does. My God, yeah. I've probably been a little bit harsh on this documentary. It was fascinating. I couldn't stop watching it.
Yeah.
I did start Googling and was curious about it. And what I loved is that it's got that cross-section of people from around the world. So people that are living in Dubai and know they can't be their true selves when they are at home. That this is their one week of escape where they get to be themselves.
The fellow from, was it?
Who was living in Dubai, the Indian fellow?
It was deeply unhappy.
They were all deeply unhappy.
This cruise crushed him.
Look, the thing, if you remember that particular subject, he came onto this cruise because he wanted to find love. Yeah. He was incredibly optimistic. He had very high expectations.
But you know what?
He was looking for a future partner on this
gay
cruise.
And what were they all saying? They hated this whole objective world. They all felt lonely and they all wanted a normal relationship. That really hurt.
And yet they were all pursuing this fantasy image of the male body.
For me, it would have been really nice to have to also maybe look at somebody who isn't coming from a character who wasn't coming from a country where most of them, where they've come from, It really is illegal or scary to be an openly gay man.
That's right. So
we never really got that perspective of a man on a cruise. They're just to enjoy the cruise.
But do you think it would have
been
different?
But could also enjoy that life. I would have liked to get that perspective because all the men there was like it was their last.
Do you think the German subject and his partner sort of represented
a
that?
A little
because
bit. That, you know, they have about, a bit more freedom back home.
To talk about white privileged member of this particular documentary. I mean, he was sort of sitting at the pinnacle and also beautiful and in good shape. And the irony was here is he had a long-term relationship, but it was like the sex in his relationship wasn't enough and they had to keep going for more.
Yeah, it was the whole – look, it's an absolutely fascinating thing. Like I said, I just struggled a little bit because they were so – I felt like, especially some of the characters, I felt like they took this –
trying to kickstart their modelling careers?
They're trying to kickstart a type of career. I'm not sure what career they're trying to kickstart. Well, not modelling, but I'm sure they're expanding.
What are you
expand,
suggesting,
you know,
Gina? What kind of – I'm just –
I have no any other career. They're naked half the time. And they're getting their gear on. But in itself, that's the whole point of this cruise.
Isn't
that's
it?
The whole point of the story that Tristan's actually telling by showing this world of people that are always on and always having to be on and how exhausting. I felt sorry for them.
And let's be honest, crushing.
Crushing.
And lonely. I think that, you know, we talked about loneliness last week when we were looking at the way that the state has kind of institutionalized loneliness.
And a lot of the comments and a lot of the relationships touch on these relationships that they're almost allowed to not have.
But I think it's so interesting that last week we were looking at the way the state has institutionalized loneliness. This week we're looking at a film which really, let's be honest, says to us that the gay community is enacting its own loneliness.
Yeah.
And that's just tragic.
Oh, listen, I have to say that this example on this gay cruise is an extreme example
it
of
is,
gay culture.
Of course.
Yes.
I mean, this is at
well, because what you're doing is putting it in a pressure cooker.
Oh, absolutely. Totally. So basically what you've got is you've brought all of these gay men who sort of buy into that that idea, and they're all on this boat. I mean, it's hideous.
And this is what Gina was saying before about it being like Tristan is clearly handpicked the people he wants to focus on in this documentary.
Well, in particular, he's actually focused on those that could be ostracized. So we had the young boy from India who. Let's face it, I think he wasn't the most attractive. And, I mean, he came into this looking...
But that's the truth.
That's the truth. He was unattractive.
Oh, there is
not
a quote.
Being judgy. This is the truth. And he also came into it with really unrealistic expectations.
Yes, he did.
So, I mean, he wanted a
normal relationship.
Yeah. On this cruise.
Yeah. Like, this is a party cruise. You're there to get your gear off and have a lot of fun safely. I loved that scene with all the condoms on the floor. Well done, boys. But, I don't think I can quote it at this time frame. He said it's not the face, it's not the abs that get you love and get you a relationship. It has to do with the phallus and the rebut. I'm using the most polite words for this time slot.
You are.
And that's what helps you sail through life. That was his quote.
We're going to be speaking with Tristan.
Front bum and back bum.
I'm doing the best I can at a 7:30 time slot, people.
We're going to be speaking with Tristan Malewski, the director of this documentary, Dreamboat, which is actually available online for anyone who wants to watch it. We're going to be speaking with Tristan right after this. You're listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where tonight we're looking at the way that Hollywood mediates the relationship between men and their bodies, and particularly queer films that grapple with these concepts. And that was a particularly interestingly timed
advertisement
sponsorship
for male fertility
spot.
It was definitely.
We've been talking about the new documentary from Tristan Malewski, Dreamboat, which I think as much as any other film does a really great job of trying to bring our attention to some of these issues.
Did it surprise you though? Like, I was fascinated watching any of this documentary.
None of us were surprised.
We all know this world. We all know friends that are part of this world. We all know how they swipe and we see it here.
And let's be honest, there was nothing novel or edgy about this documentary.
It was It was voyeuristic in a way.
It was voyeuristic. The same way people watch those Marriage at First Sight hideous things on. Yeah, Freddie.
And let's be honest, a lot
it's
of...
It's true.
Guilty as charged. Guilty. Guilty.
Can I just say I'm a bit more forgiving now that gays can get married? But anyway, moving on.
Like a lot of the kind of schlocky comedy that we were seeing featuring gay men particularly in the like late 90s, it was about very image-focused, image-saturated. Yeah. So anyway, look, I think the film does a really great job of kind of grappling with these issues, and that's why we sat down with the director of this film, Tristan Milewski, to talk about some of these issues.
It's about a cruise ship and almost 3,000 gay men, but it's not the film that you might expect when you hear that, which is men partying, having sex, and so on. But it's more about the universal quest of to live and love as who you are. And that, of course, it's somehow people might discover a boat of dreams, but of course also a boat of disillusions.
This documentary is about so much, but one of the things that it's about in particular is the gay community. And I think you ask with the documentary exactly what the gay community is.
I think what is interesting, or as a director, I'm very interested generally in diving into microcosms, because I think they, in some point, they have their own rules, but they also mirror the bigger society. And I think for this, it's revealing topics that concern gay men, but maybe also not only gay men. We see the world around us, and there's still a lot of repressive places where it's dangerous to be gay, and as long as it's like this, places like this boat are needed. And then we try to discover a place of freedom, but then again there's normativities and maybe internalized self-discrimination and not performance of masculinity, and it's many pressures, I think, that we bring on the boat, or in generally with us as gay men, that are coming from the society also, that we take over normativities from the society and kind of perform them in our own community.
That's right, and it turns out that what we thought might be liberating isn't quite as liberating as we expected.
Yeah.
The other thing that I love about this documentary is that you have people on this boat from all corners of the world. And they all come, as you've said, with their unique baggage, excuse the pun, but really, in so many ways, they're the same.
Yes, yes. I think this is what I find very interesting. But I mean, on the first hand, it was important for me to have a diversity of people, like an age, background, relationship status, etc. But then I think this is behind all this. We all have the same quest and the same need. What kind of connects everybody on this boat, whether they are from a European country or a really, really repressive country, that we all have somehow, more or less, maybe at some point, been kicked out of paradise. The path of heteronormativity and the path given by society don't fit for us. We don't match, and this can cause a lot of pain. And I think everybody on this boat somehow has this story, and this, I think, unites all of them.
It's interesting that you say that, because, yes, clearly these are people that haven't been able to find themselves on what you've called the path of heteronormativity. But are they creating, you know, they are trying to create their own paradise here. I wonder if they're creating a new kind of homonormativity that is just as truncating for them as the path of heteronormativity that they're looking to escape.
Exactly. That's the paradoxon that I wanted to explore in this film. And I think this is a very interesting tension field, that on one hand, it can be a place of freedom. On the other hand, of course, it's a place of normativities. And I mean, you really see that we all coming from a patriarch society. I think many guys have been told or have been questioned in their masculinity. And so it becomes like an internalized self discrimination, that being maybe a bit more feminine or not fitting in, the images of masculinity are very normalized. We all have been maybe questioned our masculinity at some point, and therefore might also come this over-representation of masculinity, but this again creates a lot of pressure. And you know, throwing yourself on the market. You know, it's the quest for love, but then you throw yourself on the market a bit. But then we might get emptiness or loneliness in return.
I love that you said that, because I did want to come to that. I think that's very much tied up with the kind of looksism that is so prevalent in the gay community. And I think that's something you really explore in this documentary. All of those anxieties that you're speaking about, the anxieties that are related to performing masculinity, they all kind of show themselves or rear their ugly head in this obsession that we have with looking good. And I think you really explore that in the documentary.
Yeah, thank you for these words. Yeah, I really, this is where my quest was, yeah.
So what do you think the documentary says about the importance of looking good in the gay community?
Yeah, I think in the end, I mean, it's always a bit the question, how much of the normativities do we have to take on in the end? And it's, I think, you know, on one hand, I talk about these pressure normativities that we have, not in the whole gay community, but in a big part of the gay community. And I think in the end, it's always the question, what kind of man or what kind of gay man do I want to be? It's important for me also to end a bit with empowerment that for all of the protagonists I chose, this it was also like a kind of a catharsis or inner journey. And they kind of also make their own choices in their own way in the end, and their own have their own inner questions.
Do you think any of them are liberated from the anxiety that the gay community has about looking good?
A good question. The question is how if you can really fully liberate yourself from that, but you can maybe go one step further. What you can definitely say is that they all had their journey and their questions, and they got their insights about their own questions, and definitely it was they don't leave the boat as they come on the boat.
Yeah, look, the other really interesting thing as well is that the flip side of the kind of looksism that you explore in this documentary is that the older you get, the more invisible you get.
What is very interesting was also with to talk with this old couple that they're like end 60, beginning 70, who are on this boat and who talk about really also a whole generation in their age being wiped out through HIV or through AIDS. Back then, and they all had like this back then this lack of role models of you can grow old and it can be wonderful to be gay. It's not like you're not this lonely old homosexual. I think this is also a stereotype that is really run by fear. And I think if you have a perspective on this and if you get rid of these fears, then it might also not be so stressful to grow old and to maybe not be so hot anymore or something, because you have other things to cling on and other things to create your identity on than to be the hot, muscular young guy.
That was our chat with Tristan Malewski, the director of Dreamboat, which is available online now. And after that, of course, the really compelling and kind of emotive soundtrack from Moonlight. That was The Middle of the World by Nicholas Britell. And the reason we've kind of dovetailed the interview with Tristan with this
really intense
soundtrack from Moonlight is because Moonlight, I think, as well as any other film, for all of the things that it does, it explores the relationship between masculinity and the body, and I think gives kind of narrative form to a lot of the ideas that Dreamboat tries to capture in a kind of documentary form.
Oh, I don't see that, Daniel. I don't.
I worked so hard to abridge
Daniel,
the two.
I'm sorry, I don't see.
You put a better music under it. No, I'm kidding.
No, I'm sorry. I mean, like, look, the Dreamboat was all about sex.
Maybe that's what you took from it, Alan.
And no. Can I say, Alan, and I watched it.
Having the right body will get you sex. That's what Dreamboat was about. It was about having the right look, the right body.
No. What it was about. What it was about was it was about.
Three different opinions here, people. Text in with yours. No, go.
Dreamboat was about how central the way we look is in gay culture and how we kind of shore up our sense of self, let alone our sense of masculinity, through our bodies and through cultivating our bodies. That's what Dreamboat was about. And that is what Moonlight is about, because it follows. I'm going to give you a chance to speak.
And that's what it was to you. And the sex thing was what it was to you,
look
Alan.
Look at you playing mediator. Who's right, Gina?
Neither of you.
Gina's right.
What it meant to me when I was watching that was about the role models and how the constant message, and Tristan picks up on it too, there are no gay role models. These men actually talk about not having older gay role models that they can, yet here is this global boat of 3,000 men from all over the world, all seeming to have some role model, Adonis, somewhere that they're all trying to emulate.
Do you know who else doesn't have a role model? Moonlight.
And this is the connection.
So you see, connection.
Yes.
There you go. Boom.
we got there. No. But I think he does figure in so many ways, these themes, because he starts off as this kind of scrawny kid who is trying to find himself and is vulnerable and is made to feel like crap. Mm. So how does he cope with it? He cultivates his body. Mm. He builds himself up to be this masculine kind of beacon of muscularity. And is this not what the men in Dreamboat do as well?
But if you remember in Moonlight, his road to expressing this was violence. If you remember, what really set him on this pathway was being bullied one time too many, and then he goes into school, and then he just whips that boy's ass. And I think that is the catalyst here. There's a violent
element. But the man and the masculine physique he presents, is that not of the one good male role model he has at the beginning of the film?
The drug dealer.
And I love that this film will now be, you know, men will be able to look at this film. People of colour will be able to look at this film and have a role model in the character of Tyrone in Moonlight. That's what I love.
Well, Andre Holland, who stars in Moonlight, he's the love interest in Moonlight, if we can call him that. I think we can call him a love interest.
The chef.
Actually has spoken at length about the way that the film interrogates the relationship between the body and masculinity.
I think also, probably historically, so much value has been placed on the black body and on like it being a powerful tool, that when we see images that, you know, present a counterpoint to that, you know, I imagine for some people it feels quite threatening, like personally threatening, you know what I mean? Like, well, I don't want to be seen in that way, so don't reveal that part of us, because I need for people in the world to understand that I am a person of strength and of integrity and of dignity and, you know, and so on. But what this movie does is challenges that, and it shows that there's so many different shades to masculinity, to manhood, you know what I mean? And the characters in this movie show us that vulnerability, you know, is power. Growing up for me, and probably for a lot of, you know, young boys, specifically I speak to the black boys, you know, masculinity is a big part of that. How you factor in on the scale of, like, you know, toughness and of strength, which is often measured in our community on like physical prowess, you know, not on like emotional availability or vulnerability. So for me personally, I really connected with that part of the story.
That was Andre Holland talking about masculinity in Moonlight. And I think actually really interestingly, he echoes the sentiment of Dwayne Duncan, who we heard from earlier in the program, a lecturer at the University of New England, talking about the way that the body and the muscular body is used in kind of opposition to the idea of being vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And for Chiron, he seeks to escape vulnerability by kind of shoring up his body, kind of making his body this fortress mm-hmm. of kind of muscle.
And he does that without doubt. But also too, I think, as that interview mentioned, in order to have status and influence mm. in that community mm. is often measured by their physical appearance. Mm. So it's not just the gay man and the gay girl that has that same issue.
This mm. is why I love putting a film like Moonlight and indeed a film like Dreamboat alongside a film like Goat, mm-hmm. the film from Andrew Neil, which came out, I think it was 2 years ago now, and is also actually available online. But because what this does is it takes us to a very masculine world, very kind of men's men world, and shows us how different bodies are kind of played off each other and how kind of worth as a man is located in the body.
Body, strength, power.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Mm. And but in Goat, wasn't there an assault scene? Isn't there?
There's numerous. Like, you know, so again, here we see this kind of relationship between this kind of almost triptych, the body, masculinity, and violence.
Yeah.
And we see that in Moonlight too, the kind of interrelationship mm. between the body, violence, and masculinity. And that is echoed in Goat.
And what does that say about the image we're giving to an audience about masculinity? And I mentioned, even though we are looking at gay men's, you know, bodies here, when I was mm. talking about butch lesbians representation on screen,
right. mm-hmm.
they're never these cut figures that we're seeing in anything else. They're usually violent. They're usually aggressive. They're usually prison characters. And that's, you know, and why that's not the butch women I know in my life. They're not mm. that at all.
Mm.
So why are we seeing these representations of butch women? What is that saying about that kind of masculine physique? You have to be violent. You have to be all these kind of things. Yeah.
But then they're not muscular, are
no,
they?
No, they're not muscular. They're usually overweight.
And I
overweight.
Think this comes
usually,
back to Peter yeah. Lehman and his ideas about the way that cinema really kind of divides the way it represents mm. masculinity.
Unfairly, yeah.
On the one hand, you have these kind of desired bodies, mm-hmm. the kind of muscle physique, and on the mm. other hand, you have these kind of undesirable bodies.
Mm. Mm.
And that is what a lot of lesbian films, let's be honest, do.
Well, I really sometimes find it really hard to pick a really positive butch
yeah.
lesbian role model in a film. I mean, I myself am a, you know, classify myself as a butch lesbian. I haven't got many that I can point and say, yep, I really identify with that yeah. character.
And this almost, strangely enough, comes, a film like Tom of Finland, I think, works really well in this context, because what it does is it shows us how kind of fantasy then plays into this discussion mm. and how it really does kind of deal with, you know, you throw in another kind of important idea like fantasy and the way that the bodies, because Tom of Finland really explores how these kind of bodies, these kind of ultra-masculine bodies, are the product of kind of fantasy and desire, and they come out of kind of dark places, really.
But talk about the influence of film and popular mm. culture and how that manifests sure. in men's bodies. I mean, look at Tom of Finland. I mean, it clearly demonstrated that Tom of Finland had such a massive impact on queer culture that people actually started to adopt the mm. stereotypes and the tropes that he presented in his art.
Well, it kind of went into the kind of washing machine that we call culture,
yeah,
and did have, and like it wasn't solely responsible for it, but like it was complicit mm. in shaping the way that we think about how men should look.
Mm.
And I think that the film does a really interesting job of kind of exploring some of those issues.
I just know when I was watching, and when we watch some of these films, sometimes I catch myself and I think, wow, what would a nice vanilla little straight audience think of this. This I thought of Dreamboat. I did catch myself going, I know this world. I know men in this world. I'm very comfortable in this world. Nothing about this offends me. I'm very comfortable watching this on screen. And then sometimes I catch myself and go, shit. How would another audience perceive this? Because, you know, we've got our own culture of role models and representations that we've grown up with. And we see this in Dreamboat. It's global. The message is global. Everyone seems to catch in on that same message. We're all drinking the Kool-Aid, you know.
But, you know, so there are points, I guess, at which one of the, if I can just kind of tease apart what you're saying, one of the, like, there are times that we become conscious of the kind of messages that we're being fed. And then there are other times where we don't. Like, I think it's really interesting to put a film like Tom of Finland, say, alongside a film like, I don't know, The Hulk or Captain America or Thor, where on the one hand we have a film that kind of explores how these impossible bodies are the product of fantasy and desire and dark, the kind of experience that Tom of Finland himself went through to produce these images are dark. And then on the other hand, we have the image, right, that he projected into the world or in the person of Chris Hemsworth or Chris Evans, and they are, you know, no one really thinks twice, or few people do, about the fact that we kind of take these kind of bodies as an example of how we should look.
But I think Tom Finland's motive for his art was really to push back against the representation of gay people at that time, which often presented gay men as a stereotype, as feminine, fops, farcical, comical characters. And he wanted to bring that power back to the gay world and also back to gay men. So I think, you know, I think in a sense that was actually a positive thing that was a positive.
It almost reminds me.
It was countercultural.
In that way, it almost, again, reminds me of a film like Against the Law, which we looked at last week. We had this kind of...
what is acceptable.
Right.
Yeah.
But it also chronicled the acceptable ways of being homosexual.
Yes.
Peter Wildblood, who the film chronicled, had some very unsavory things to say about how we should be. Exactly. Yeah. And that is the same as Tom of Finland, really, isn't it? Because there was a lot about his images that were, you know, homophobic almost, anti-gay.
Huge internalized homophobia in that. Yeah.
In Against the Law. Oh,
not yeah, without in, a in, doubt. In Tom of Finland, too. Like... You're not buying it.
No, I'm not buying it, Daniel. I'm like going, how is that homophobic? Any of that homophobic?
Because,
I don't get
because he was rallying against the aesthete, the femme. This was femme shaming true and proper.
Gotcha. Yeah, boom. Yeah, now I understand. But I think, you know, he was trying to push back against the
cultural
representation of gay men.
Absolutely
at that time.
He was, but let's not pretend there wasn't collateral damage.
Now I get you. Now I understand your comments there around the darker side behind that representation. That really it was.
But also, he produced he was a victim of war, really. I mean, this is what Tom of Finland, the film, shows us. And of course, we've done a whole episode looking at this film. We spoke with Dome Karakoski, the director of the film, and that's available online. But I've lost my train of thought through the plug. The plug, it threw me off. But the point I was making was that he produced these images in a really dark time in his life as a way of escaping. They were fantasy. Purely fantasy. And what we have now is a stream of popular Hollywood films that are feeding us these images as real life. They're not fantasy anymore. They're the way that we need to be. And we soak that up and it frames the way that we think about ourselves and our bodies. And it's noxious and dangerous, and we don't think about it as a society enough and the harmful effects enough.
You know what? I think it's time for an uprising. Daniel, Gina,
lead the way.
You know what? I think dad bods need to rule the world, take it over, and, you know, like turn this whole paradigm on its head.
We are chatting about the way that cinema mediates the relationship between men and their bodies and the gay community and its preoccupation with the body beautiful. More on Outtakes coming up right after this.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we have been exploring the way that film mediates the relationship between gay men and their bodies, and some particularly pertinent examples of queer cinema that challenges the way that the body is used as this kind of locus or metonym for masculinity and hegemonic masculinity, like mainstream masculinity.
You know what? This is such a fascinating topic. We've covered it before, and I'm sure we'll cover it again. And speaking about cover, you know, Daniel, I think it's time now for you to put your shirt back on.
This
display of masculinity, overt masculinity throughout this program, it's quite enough.
Oh, my God.
Put it back on, Daniel.
Did not see that coming. I don't know where
None of us came from. But I love you, Alan.
What are we doing next week?
Oh, what's next week?
Well, next week we're turning our attention to the Queer Screen Film Fest up in Sydney, which runs before Mardi Gras every year, and they have a fantastic program, lineup
Huge
of really
program.
Important queer films, a lot of which I'm sure we'll see at MQFF, which follows.
Hopefully, yeah.
So it's going to be a jam-packed program next week. We need to thank Tristan Milewski. Mm. Apologies to Tristan for mispronouncing his last name throughout
online. Check it out. This is, you know, it's hard to get these kind of really fascinating documentaries that are so accessible. Mm. Go online, see it, watch it. Love to know what you think.
That's it for another week on Outtakes.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.